in the world of sports. She's got next. Next. Here's Jordan Robinson.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of She's Got Next. I'm Jordan Robinson, your host and women's sports super fan. That's me. Today, we have a lot of women's sports stories to cover. Per usual, we've got the latest headlines, the most up-to-date news, and we have an amazing interview waiting for you later on in the show with the tennis expert. So make sure to stick around for that. It's great and super informative. But first, I wanted to start off by saying I went to my first women's sports only bar last Friday, and it was everything that I could have ever wanted. Every TV had on either the WNBA or the NWSL. The place was buzzing. Fans came in their jerseys. It was incredible. I live in Los Angeles, so I went to Untamed Sports Bar in Silver Lake, one of the newer ones on the scene. I was eating nachos, my favorite food, while watching women's sports, my favorite thing, and talking sports with some of my favorite people. Wow. Please look up your closest women's sports bar nearest to you and go. If you remember earlier in the season, I went on this whole spiel about how women's sports bars are the future. So make sure you go. You will have fun. Okay. Had to get that out the way. In case you missed last week's episode, please go back and look it up because it was all about flag football and how it's the fastest growing sport in the world. On the youth side, the number of 6 to 12 year olds playing sports has actually increased by 38% to more than 1.5 million since 2015. That is wonderful news. And NFL flag is a huge part of that. It's the largest flag football league in the U.S. with more than 1,800 leagues in 50 states. But we learned from our guest, Rebecca Landa, who is an ESPN play-by-play announcer, reporter, and professional women's flag football athlete for the Mexican national team, that there is a real professional track developing here. With the Olympics right around the corner in 2028, the first time flag football will be spotlighted, the sport is gaining traction. I, for one, can't wait to see the two top women's national teams go head to head in a potential gold medal game, the United States and Mexico. Of course, I'm pulling for USA, but I'll also be rooting for Rebecca too, because she's really cool. So again, if you haven't listened to that episode, you still can search for She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson, wherever you get your podcasts. All right. On today's episode of She's Got Next, we're going back to a tennis deep dive. It's been a minute since we've checked in. We had a tennis expert, Charlie Eccleshire, on the show to preview Wimbledon and give us the 4-1-1 on women's tennis at that point in the season. But so much has happened since then. So we're due for another check-in. The Canadian Open was last month, and the biggest story out there was Victoria Mbogo's Cinderella story. She is a teen sensation. She won her first WTA Tour title. She beat four former Grand Slam title winners to hoist the trophy. But the best part, she got to do it in her home country. She's Canadian. She defeated Naomi Osaka in the final, which was also a win in itself to see Naomi back on the main stage like that. It was awesome. And most recently, the Cincinnati Open, it served as a wonderful primer of maybe what we're going to see in the upcoming U.S. Open tournament. Iga Swiatek has been on fire. She won that final and continues to prove that she is nothing to mess with. The Polish star has already won Wimbledon this season, too. Also, it came to my attention while researching this and putting all these numbers together, she's only 24 years old. For some reason, she just gives off an older, mature vibe, but she's only 24 and she has won 6 Grand Slams already. That is super impressive. So later on, you'll hear from senior editor of tennis at The Athletic. Me and him, we'll talk through all of this. We'll preview the US Open, the final Grand Slam of the season held in New York City. We discuss if Swiatek can keep this hot streak going, how Coco Gauff needs to limit those double faults. Like, it's time that it's time. Venus Williams, she's back at the US Open, baby. Can't be more hyped. Naomi Osaka's recent coaching change, is that going to help her, hurt her? We'll see. And if Aryna Sabalenka can finally get over the hump and win a slam this season. She has been in multiple finals and she won the US Open last year, but there hasn't been a back-to-back champion since Serena Williams in 2015. It always comes back to Serena, doesn't it? You just have to talk about her when we talk about tennis. That's coming up soon, but before we get to our guests, let's dive into the Women's Sports Week recap. First, the Portland Thorns set a 2025 NWSL attendance record this week with 21,811 fans packed their arena for their rivalry game against the Seattle Reign. We love rivalries. The Thorns won 4-2. It was 95 degrees outside and people still showed up for them. Portland is such an amazing city for women's sports, from the first women's sports bar, the Sports Bra, opening there, to a new WNBA expansion team coming next year. This doesn't surprise me, and I love that it was specifically for a rivalry game. That's awesome. Also in NWSL news, Alyssa Nair, you know, the 10-year U.S. national team goalkeeper. Yeah, she's all that. She scored her first ever NWSL goal in extra time. Please go on Instagram, TikTok, wherever, and watch those highlights. It was so cool. In her 200th regular season appearance, her goal tied up with Seattle. I love that. It's never too late to do something new in your career. Huge shout out to a rising star on our hands, Australia's Monica Arcuri. She became the 24th girl to play in the Little League Baseball World Series and the 11th to record a hit. There's this super cute interview with her giving advice to other girls, saying, if people say girls can't play baseball, forget about that. Girls can play. And I love that so much. She is a future star. We know everything with Monet Davis. She's still riding that high of being a pitcher in Little League. So super excited for Monica. And lastly, we have a new baller in the Professional Women's Hockey League. And I don't mean on the ice, but in the bank. Ottawa Charge forward Emily Clark extended her contract this offseason to earn more than $100,000 per year, a new single season PWHL record. In this league's early years, I hope this can set the stage for more players earning bigger bucks, as all women's pro athletes should. All right. I hope you feel caught up. After the break, back to tennis. We're going to hear from James Hansen, senior editor at The Athletic, on the other side. This is She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
From Odyssey Sports, it's She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
Today's guest is James Hansen, senior editor for The Athletic's tennis coverage. James, welcome to She's Got Next.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. I love tennis. Everyone on the show listening knows how much I love tennis. I love playing with my husband. So this is a fun time of the tennis season right now. And we're going to talk about it. Let's talk about all things women's tennis. Before we get into the US Open coverage that's coming up, let's look back to the Cincinnati Open that just wrapped, because a lot went down, a lot happened, a lot of names popped out. Iga Świątek took the crown. But what were some of your highlights when we think about women's tennis coming out of this last tournament?
An amazing win for Świątek, who, by her own admission, has won the two events this year that she probably thought she was least likely to win, in Wimbledon and the Cincinnati Open. Historically, she's found faster conditions a little more difficult, but I think in Cincinnati especially, the incredibly hot weather makes a ball bounce higher, and that really helps her really heavy topspin game kind of dominate opponents. I think the highlight for me was kind of the sequence of matches from Aryna Sabalenka's amazingly close win over Emma Raducanu, a three-set match that went to, yeah, incredibly close. Raducanu maybe feels like she could have pulled it out, didn't quite do it. We then had Sabalenka running into just a dialed-in version of Elena Rybakina, the 2022 Wimbledon champion, who, when she's playing well, is just one of the most effortless players to watch in the women's game. Like, she hits the ball with incredible power, but it looks like she's barely doing anything at all. She, you know, played lights out. Sabalenka tried lots of things to do something. She just couldn't do it. And then Rybakina ran into Świątek, and, you know, that had the potential to be a really incredible match. That's exactly what it proved to be. Świątek, as she did in the French Open, in their match there in the fourth round, I think it was, you know, Rybakina started incredibly fast, but Świątek stayed with her better than at the French Open. In the French Open, she lost the first set 6-1 about 15 minutes, still won the match. Mm-hmm. This one, they both served incredibly well. Świątek kept it tight. And then, as has happened a few times this year, unfortunately for Rybakina, she got to the moment where she had to serve out a set and couldn't quite do it. And from then on, Świątek went from 3-5 down to 7-5 up. And as soon as she won that first set, she kind of just took over the match and rolled through her. So then we got the final of Świątek versus Paolini. And Paolini, I think, had an amazing year in 2024. She reached two Grand Slam finals, won her first WTA 1000 title. And although her slam results this year haven't reached those heights, she's really backed up the fact that she is now a proper top 10 player. And she pushed Świątek hard in the Cincinnati final. She went 3-love up in the first set. She, in the second set, twice, kind of, you know, when Świątek, when she wins a tight set, sometimes the next one, she just goes down the hill and, like, rolls over her opponent completely. It looked like she was going to do that again. Paolini didn't let her. They had this kind of back and forth. I'll break your serve, you'll break mine. And Świątek just did it enough at the right time to win the title. And yeah, it was an incredible event and a really good primer for the US Open, because it means that Sabalenka, defending champion there, but also really kind of now has Świątek on her heels for the race for number one at the end of the year. And Sabalenka obviously will be desperate to win this title, because she's not won a major this year. She's been to two finals, lost them both, both very close matches. And, you know, you don't have to win a Grand Slam every year to be an incredible tennis player. But Sabalenka, the competitor that she is, she will want this last one and to defend her title.
Absolutely. The race for the number one ranking is going to be incredible as we're getting to the final Grand Slam. But that was a great recap of everything that went down. And I just have a question, especially for maybe the listeners who are an new tennis fan. So the Cincinnati Open is a part of the tour. It's a part of the season, and it's leading up to a Grand Slam. But these are still major matches, and they still have major implications. So can you kind of explain that difference between maybe a WTA tour tournament versus a Grand Slam, and why they kind of need each other to coexist?
Yeah, so on a basic level, the WTA tour has four levels of event. Even though the tour doesn't operate the Grand Slams, they are considered part of their season because they're in the season.
Got it.
So there's the four majors, the Australian, French, and US Opens and Wimbledon. Then the tier below that is the 1000 event, like Cincinnati is a 1000 event. There are 10 of those on the WTA tour. And they are the biggest events, quote unquote, on the tour, because the slams technically exist outside of them. But like you say, they're also positioned in the calendar that they often lead into the Grand Slams. So before the French Open, there's the Madrid Open in Spain, the Italian Open in Rome on clay. There isn't a 1000 leading up to Wimbledon on grass. It's only smaller events. And the there isn't one leading up to the Australian Open either, to kind of keep that runway from the off season into the first Grand Slam of the year, kind of its own little part of the year. And there's a lot of tennis politics that goes into that that we could go into, but that will be a whole other show. So maybe another
whole another episode.
but yeah, the 1,000 events, they're interesting because the best players like Sabalenka, Swiatek, Coco Gauff, they want to win these titles. Like, they mean a lot for their rankings, because if you earn, you win one, you get 1,000 points. That's a lot of points. But they can also sometimes be opportunities for players who are maybe further down the rankings to win a big title, because if it's not happened so much this year, but if you think when Swiatek's been dominating the French Open 4 years prior to this one, she was also going deep or winning the two 1,000 events, Madrid and Rome. But playing and winning three tournaments in which you've got to win seven matches to win a tournament all in a row in the calendar is, you know, physically and mentally incredibly taxing. So a lot of times, if there's 1,000 just after a Grand Slam, the better kind of top players who have gone deep in the previous event might skip it. That's what happened in Canada. Sabalenka didn't play after Wimbledon because she wanted to rest after losing in the semifinals to Amanda Anisimova, who, she's a good example of a player who won her first 1,000 title this year in Doha, Qatar. And of course, Victoria Mboko won the Canadian Open as a wild card because, you know, she's an unbelievable tennis player, and her, we can maybe talk about her a bit more, because her ranking where she was at the start of the year is kind of like not really the full truth of how good she is as a tennis player. And, you know, she in part took advantage of, Sabalenka not being there. Swiatek went out early. But, you know, Mboko had to beat four Grand Slam champions to win that title. Gauff, Spear, Kenin, Elena Rybakina, and Naomi Osaka. So, you know, these events are, they're not, when players reckon with their careers, they will want, if they can, to be able to say, yeah, I won a major, even if it's just one. But, you know, anyone who wins a 1,000 level title is a serious tennis player, even if it's just one. So they're important.
It's still a big deal. That's also what I wanted to get across. You mentioned Victoria Mboko. Let's talk about her, because I'm obsessed with the story. A teenage phenom hailing from Canada. It was all over my social media. I couldn't escape it. It was, I'm sure if you are really in the tennis community, you know her, you knew her talent. But for us on the outside, it was like, where did she come from? Who is she? Did she just kind of drop in here? And especially being so young and just having this incredible run. So I ask you, is she the real deal? Or was that kind of a one-off Cinderella story?
She is most definitely the real deal. There are, you know, instances where tennis can have players who sort of genuinely emerge from nowhere and make an amazing run. The most recent example probably isn't in women's tennis. It will be in the men's Cincinnati Open. Terence Atman from France, world number 136, I think, got to the semifinals, having not done a great deal this season, not just on like the main ATP tour, but the rungs below. His game is incredibly high aggression, all out attack. And if someone like that plays really well for a week, they're really, really hard to beat. And that's what happened. And Mboko, though, and Loïs Boisson, who got to the semifinals of the French Open earlier this year, are two examples of players who, yeah, look like Cinderella stories, who just kind of got dropped from the sky from this like other tennis planet and arrived fully formed to beat all the best people in the game. But both of them, Mboko especially, have been on like ridiculous winning streaks on the ITF tour, which is the third rung of professional tennis. So there's WTA, the events we were talking about. There's a bit confusingly WTA 125, which is second tier, but still has WTA and a number like all the other events, but it is a separate kind of category of event. And then the ITF tour, and Mboko was just winning and winning and winning on that level. She showed that she could mix it with the better players even before the French Open, which was where she kind of announced herself to the wider tennis world by getting to the third round. She pushed Paula Badosa very closely, who's top 10-ish player, and Goff as well in Rome. Like, Goff beat her fairly straightforwardly, but said after, like, you know, she's going to be a proper player. And yeah, just when you have the confidence that comes with winning, I think she's won 51 matches in a year now, including her Canadian Open run. Like,
wow.
Doesn't matter what level you're at, doesn't matter the caliber of opponent you're playing, like, winning does breed winning. And she was able to stay there when, you know, much more starrier names in the sport kind of couldn't handle the pressure against her. And, you know, she's seeded for the US Open now, which means that it's not the situation where if she'd not been seeded, she could have drawn like a Sabalenka or a Swiatek in the first round and provided like an incredible opening match. So now hopefully she can win her first two matches and then play like a really big seed in the third round and have a really incredible match again. And the other thing to say is just like, in the same way that winning breeds winning, like, just because she did so well in Canada, like, doesn't mean that people should be piling these expectations on her. Like, oh, she's going to win the US Open. She's going to be the best player in the world. Like, tennis doesn't work like that. It takes a long time for some players to really get comfortable being on the big stage all the time. So yeah, she's an incredible talent, definitely the real deal. But equally, to fans who've just like seen her, if she loses in the first round of the US Open, don't be like, oh no, it's a disaster. It's just
that's helpful. No, expectations are very helpful for spectators, because I think there's a little bit of this, like, we see phenom, we see young, and we're like, is it happening again? Is this another Coco Gauff? Is this another Serena Williams? Like, just being able to, we've seen it before, so we're hoping that it's going to happen again, but to tame those expectations and allow her time to grow, especially on this type of stage. I think it's so cool that she was able to prove herself, got the fanfare, got the followers, have new fans, but now we can just be a part of the process rather than expecting her to come out and win right away. So I love that. So moving on to the US Open, you talked about how Mboko is going to be seeded. This is the last fourth Grand Slam of the season. And I wanted to ask you, because this has been a long season, I'm sure, with everything that we just talked about, with all the ups and downs of players, what typically is the vibe and overall feelings coming into this last season? You mentioned how some players are going to want to, this is our last chance. They haven't gotten one all season. They won a title. This is it. Or fatigue is starting to set in. Like, what is the overall vibe coming into this US Open?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's definitely possible that a surprise winner might come out just because of its placement in the season. You know, players are starting to get tired, especially the kind of biggest stars in the sport who tend to go deep in most tournaments they play. There's also, I think, the US Open is kind of one of the most intense slams, I think, like, for being, for some players anyway, like Iga Swiatek, when she won it in 2022, she, sorry for the home crowd, but she said she doesn't love New York because it's quite a full-on city experience, and that's not
it's a lot. It's overwhelming.
Yeah, some players kind of thrive on that very high energy more than others do. And like we were talking about with Mboko, like, expectations can kind of play both ways. Like, the States has a lot of really highly ranked players at the moment. There's Goff, Madison Keys, who won the Australian Open, Jessica Pegula, Amanda Anisimova, all of whom might thrive with a home crowd behind them. They also might feel some pressure. Goff last year, lost in the fourth round to Emma Navarro in the match that kind of made her say, like, right, I'm serving too many double faults. I really need to fix this. Fired Brad Gilbert as a coach, brought on Matt Daly, who specializes in kind of the grip mechanics of tennis and how you should hold the racket to achieve a certain effect with a certain shot. That looked like it was kind of working for a while. That was partly because she was playing a lot of the tour finals indoor events and then other kind of not so fast hardcore events, which maybe made it look like she'd made more progress on her serve than she actually had, which is fine. Like, the serve is the most complex biomechanic motion in tennis. It's really hard to change. Arina Sabalenka went through this when she had a similar double fault problem. She couldn't hit a serve in some matches, including a one against Goff in Canada, where she at the end like sat with her team in tears and was like, you know, what the hell am I going to do? And her team were like, well, you're going to have to remake your whole serve, which is one of the scariest things you can tell a tennis player. She hired a biomechanics coach. She did it. And now she's won number one, has won majors, like, incredible transformation. But Goff, the serve is becoming an issue again. It wasn't great in Canada. It was better in Cincinnati until she lost to Paolini, had a bit of a rough serving day then. So lots of factors combined to make it, in some ways, an open tournament. In others, I think you look at it at the moment with the form players are in, the things that are going to be driving them there. And I would say that, especially now that Swiatek is won number two again, so is on the opposite side of the draw to Sabalenka at number one. I think those two are favorites to get to the final, but, you know, do not count out something completely different to that. So, yeah, don't hold me to it, because US Open is one major where, you know, it's kind of up for grabs.
Well, I remember we had your colleague Charlie Eccleshare on earlier in the season when we were previewing Wimbledon, and we talked about how in women's tennis, there has been a different winner every single time, and it hasn't been kind of this core four going to the same semifinals, going to the same finals every single time. Yeah. So I think that's exciting, but he mentioned that sometimes that can be harder for a new fan because you don't have those same names kind of swirling all the time. So it's super interesting. You mentioned you talk a little bit about coaches, and I just wanted to ask really quick, because I know you wrote about Naomi Osaka changing her coach. Mm. Is that typical that happens kind of this late in the season and kind of trying to make an adjustment? What do you make of that?
I think just to draw on the thing you mentioned about winners, the US Open also the same players, like some players have won it twice, but no one has defended it since Serena Williams in 2014. So that, again, yeah, it's hard to win this title twice in a row, and that's what Arina Sabalenka will want to do. With Osaka, I think that she, you know, since she came back to the tour at the start of 2024, after giving birth to her first child, having time off to be a mum and go through everything that entails, including recovering as an elite athlete after giving birth. That's an incredibly challenging process. She has gone through quite a complicated kind of sequence in which, partly because of injuries, partly because of some kind of close lost matches, she's never quite figured out what she wants this comeback to be. I think she's said lots along the way, her benchmarking for what she wants has kind of changed. So if you go back to last year when she was still with Wim Fassett, who now coaches Swiatek, she lost to Swiatek at the French Open, but had a match point, like, very nearly beat her in an amazing match under the roof. And she said something like, you know, the results aren't resulting right now, but it's okay because I'm playing good tennis, like, it's going to come, which is a very healthy way to look at results. By about 6 months later, she was saying, like, you know, if my ranking doesn't get better, I might quit this whole thing.
Wow.
Like, she's changed as she's gone through this comeback, like what she thinks she needs to do to be the player she wants to be, but the player she wants to be has also changed. To do that, next version of that, she hired Patrick Mouratoglou, Serena Williams' former coach, kind of known more for his ability to like hype players up and figure out the thing that really makes them tick and just tell them to do that over and over again, more so maybe than someone like Fissette, who is a bit more of a kind of cerebral technique-minded coach. The Mouratoglou relationship, they both said at various times, maybe didn't gel as they wanted from a communication perspective. Like, neither of them has said that outright, but things they've said about it kind of hint in that direction. Mm-hmm. So instead, Osaka, yeah, before the Canadian Open, hired Thomas Victorowski, who is Iga Świątek's coach from when she was kind of dominating tennis. I think for Osaka, it's a smart move. I think very immediately in the matches she played in Canada, it was clear that she was moving better than she has for a while. She's always been actually an athletic tennis player, but like the precise kind of footwork to get to balls was sometimes not as precise as it could have been. It looked really good up until she played in Boko and lost then in the final. I think that Victorowski, a bit like Fissette, is quite an intense, full-on coach when it comes to like getting a player's game right, maybe more than their state of mind. I think Osaka, in a way, needs that more than she needs the mental side, despite the fact that she's, you know, always been very open about the fact that sometimes tennis doesn't make her feel like her best self.
Mm-hmm.
I think of late, it's more been that she's not been able to produce her best tennis when matches have gone close that has made her have this kind of like, you know, you look at the result sheet and it's like loss, loss, loss. But she went through a sequence of, I think, 7 or 8 matches where she lost in the third set, so got to 1-1. And she lost the third set either 6-4, so really close, or in a tiebreak. So it's not like she's been a million miles away from winning these matches. It's just a case of finding that technique, like when she really needs it. And that was her superpower when she was winning Grand Slams. Like, no matter how close a match was, she would just find a first serve or like find a big forehand and take a point away from someone who maybe thought they'd won it. And yeah, I hope she can find whatever level of tennis it is that he wants to, because she's hugely important for the sport, incredible competitor, great advocate for women's tennis, for tennis at large, for being a decent person in society even. And yeah, I think Victorowski can definitely help her do that.
I love that. You know, I think it goes a little bit what we were talking about before with expectation, and there was a lot of expectation when Naomi Osaka kind of came onto the scene, and to be able to have your start your family and come back, and your comeback can look different at different points. And maybe that changes, especially when you start playing really well. You're like, okay, actually I want to do better. I want to go to another level, and to have that freedom to kind of change that. So I'm excited to see, like you said, whatever that comeback looks like for her. And I'm sure all tennis fans are excited about that. Speaking of comeback, though, Venus Williams has bursted back onto the scene, and it has made young Jordan so happy to see Venus out there playing again. First of all, how fun has this been to see her at 45 winning matches and now able to get a wild card coming into US Open? How fun is that to cover? And just what is the tennis community talking about Venus Williams?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. The funny thing about it is that we all thought this was going to happen in March. She, you know, the Indian Wells, another 1000 event, all over their social media saying Venus Williams, wildcard, coming to Indian Wells. I was like, wow, what? That's incredible. 3 days later, she's at an event in, I think, Norway, gets asked about it on stage and is like, I'm not playing Indian Wells. I'm not going to be in the country.
Oh, no.
Okay. So that wild card didn't happen, but, you know, she made no secret of the fact that she had been back on the court, like training, keeping herself kind of in shape and wanting to see if there was an opportunity to play again. She then gets this wild card into the DC Open, which is a 500 event, so slightly smaller than Indian Wells. And she wins her first match against a top 30 player in Peyton Stearns. And it's just an amazing demonstration of so many things. Like, it shows that, yes, tennis is a sport of athleticism and fitness and physicality, but if you've got the skill and technique that someone like Venus Williams, 7-time Grand Slam champion in singles, you know, over 10 in doubles, one of the best serves still, based on what she did in Washington on the tour. Like, she can mix it with people who are half her age and probably feel like they shouldn't be losing to someone who's 45, if I'm being honest, even if she is a 7-time Grand Slam champion.
Yeah.
It was also amazing to see she, either between or before her singles match, she played doubles with Hayley Baptiste, who's a, you know, young Black American women's player, kind of trying to make her mark on the tour a bit later than maybe some people thought she might. And DC is still, unfortunately, one of few tennis events where the diversity of the crowd is like an accurate reflection of the diversity of the city that it's in. Yeah, knowing that Venus is going to walk on to almost certainly Arthur Ashe Stadium to a full house in her first round match again is, yeah, unbelievable.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I can't wait to see how that unfolds, because it has been magical to see her back on a tennis court, and she's just playing so well right now. Okay, we have to take a quick break. After, I'll continue my conversation with James and we'll get into the business side of women's tennis. You're listening to She's Got Next with Jordan Robinson.
Let's get down to business. Here's what's happening in the business of women's sports.
Welcome back to She's Got Next. For this week's Let's Get Down to Business segment, we're back with James Hansen, senior editor at The Athletic, to have a money talk about women's tennis. Take a listen. Last question before I let you go, and I want to talk about the money part, because that is something we love talking about on the show, and we want every women's sports player to get more money. And now the U.S. Open has raised their purse right now, right? And I think that is so huge, and it's historic. $5 million now, a record for the winner, up 20% from last year. So I guess my question is, how exciting is that? And what do you attribute to that growth and more money to be invested at this level?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, especially now, because, you know, you look at figures like 5 million for a singles champion, 90 million total player compensation, 85 million of that is prize money, 5 million goes to like food and hotels, which you don't get those for winning. So it's not technically prize money, but it's still part of the compensation. The interesting thing is that the kind of figure that everyone in tennis is looking at is not 85 million, it's 15%. And that's because 85 million is about 15% of 560 million, which is how much money the US Open made last year. And the big sort of money talking point in tennis right now is that players up and down the circuit, but most visibly kind of players higher up the rankings, want their prize money in terms of proportionality to be closer to that of like NBA, NFL, NHL leagues, where like, look, tennis is probably one of the best paying women's sports that there is, but in terms of the percentage of revenue they receive in those leagues, you're looking at like 45-50. In tennis, Grand Slam, 15-20. At a tour level event, it might rise to anywhere between 20-30. But the players say, well, you know, without us, you don't have a tournament. So why is so much revenue not going to us? The slams, which have entered into dialogues with players over this, say that, like, look, our responsibility in the four tennis nations that host Grand Slams, so Australia, France, the UK, England, probably technically for this purpose, and the US, like, you know, we have to, part of our job is to reinvest in tennis in those countries. So a lot of the, and to reinvest in the slams themselves, because that's the other part of the raising prize money, is that the US Open raising its prize money will mean that next year the other slams will be like, oh, we need to raise our prize money too. Other events. So prior to this, the biggest tour pool prize money, individual prize money for a winner, I think was a WTA and ATP Tour Finals last year. Coco Gauff got something like over $3 million for winning the Tour Finals. And that means that, again, other tour events will, oh, we need to also raise our prize money. And so this dynamic ensues where the slams are basically constantly trying to one-up each other on every level, whether that's like facilities for players, facilities for fans, capacity of crowds, hosting, qualifying, and now in the case of the US Open, a real event, the mixed doubles, in the week before to kind of become like a three-week proper event rather than a fortnight, because a week extra of tickets and TV revenue and sponsorship revenue is more money for the tournament. So yeah, it's like this kind of self-perpetuating, keeping up with the Joneses type situation, basically. The sort of caveat is that the US Open or the USTA is one of the richer nations, like, and also exchange rates. The Australian Open, to reach this US dollar amount of prize money, they'd have to, we're talking hundreds of millions of Australian dollars. So that probably not very likely to happen, but this is the reason that they do it, is to kind of say, like, you know, we're the best slam, we're treating the players the best, what can you do? But it's all happening against this backdrop of players kind of wanting that money to be more in step with what they see elite athletes in like other American leagues receiving. So it's a very exciting financial time in tennis, even if that sounds like a complete oxymoron.
No, that is exciting. No, that's exciting. And I typically cover the WNBA. So WNBA players are also going through that right now, wanting more rev share because they deserve it. And again, it's this type of idea of there's no tournament without us. So if you don't want to pay us, then you won't have the money that you're making. So it has to kind of coexist with each other. That's fascinating. I think that was a really great breakdown and a good insight of what's going on behind the scenes. Because you just see the dollar amount and everyone's like, yay, but there's more fight to be had on that front. James, thank you so much. I learned so much. I'm ready for the US Open. I'm going to have my tennis skirt laid out so that I can watch. This is going to be a great tournament, again, to end this fantastic tennis season. Thank you for your time, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's going to be a great tournament, I'm sure.
Thank you again to James for coming on the show. He's so knowledgeable about the sport, and I, for one, learned so much. I hope you did too. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you for listening to She's Got Next. I'm Jordan Robinson, and I'll see you next time.